letters in the title, he had to laugh at himself. Besides, there were only 16. He put the book back and took up another, this one with a drawing of a soldier on the front. He could make out one word of the title, dead. He looked at another. A man and woman kissing on the cover. Yes, there were always men and women kissing in stories. Folks like that. He put it back and looked up to check on Callahan's progress. His eyes widened slightly as he saw the pair walking into a great room filled with books and what Eddie called Magda scenes. Although Roland was still unsure what Magda had seen or why there should be so much written about it. He pulled out another book and smiled at the picture on the cover. There was a church with the sun going down red behind it. The church looked a bit like Our Lady of Serenity. He opened it and thumbed through it. A delah of words, but he could only make out one in every three, if that. No pictures. He was about to put it back when something caught his eye, leaped at his eye. Roland stopped breathing for a moment. He stood back, no longer hearing the Todash chimes, no longer caring about the great room of books Callahan had entered. He began reading the book with the church on the front, or trying to. The words swam maddeningly in front of his eyes, and he couldn't be sure, not quite, but gods, if he was seeing what he thought he was seeing. Intuition told him that this was a key, but to what door? He didn't know. Couldn't read enough of the words to know, but the book in his hands seemed almost to thrum. Roland thought that perhaps this book was like the rose. But there were black roses, too. 9.
Roland, I found it. It's a little town in central Maine called East Stoneham, about 40 miles north of Portland, and...
He stopped, getting a good look at the gunslinger.
What's wrong?
The chiming sound, Roland said quickly. Even with my ears stopped up, it got through. The door was shut and the chimes were gone, but there were still the voices. Callahan's father was currently asking if Donnie thought those magazines he'd found under his son's bed were anything a Christian boy would want to have. What if his mother had found them? And when Roland suggested they leave the cave, Callahan was more than willing to go. He remembered that conversation with his old man far too clearly. They had ended up praying together at the foot of his bed, and the three playboys had gone into the incinerator out back. Roland returned the carved box to the pink bag and once more stowed it carefully behind Tower's case of valuable books. He had already replaced the book with the church on it, turning it with the title down so he could find it again quickly. They went out and stood side by side, taking deep breaths of the fresh air.
"Are you sure the chimes is all it was?"
Callahan asked.
"Man, you looked as though you'd seen a ghost."
"The Todash chimes are worse than ghosts," Roland said. That might or might not be true, but it seemed to satisfy Callahan. As they started down the path, Roland remembered the promise he had made to the others, and more important, to himself. No more secrets within the Tet. How quickly he found himself ready to break that promise. But he felt he was right to do so. He knew at least some of the names in that book. The others would know them too. Later they would need to know if the book was as important as he thought it might be. But now it would only distract them from the approaching business of the wolves. If they could win that battle, then perhaps...
"Roland, are you quite sure you're okay?"
"Yes." He clapped Callahan on the shoulder. The others would be able to read the book, and by reading might discover what it meant. Perhaps the story in the book was just a story. But how could it be when... "Pear?"
"Yes, Roland."
"A novel is a story, isn't it? A made-up story?"
"Yes, a long one."
"But make-believe."
"Yes, that's what fiction means, make-believe."
Roland pondered this. Charlie the Choo-Choo had also been make-believe, only in many ways, many vital ways, it hadn't been. And the author's name had changed. There were many different worlds, all held together by the tower. Maybe... No, not now. He mustn't think about these things now. "Tell me about the town where Tower and his friend went," Roland said.
"I can't, really. I found it in one of the main telephone books, that's all. Also, a simplified zip code map that showed about where it is."
"Good, that's very good.
Roland, are you sure you're all right?
Calla, Roland thought. Callahan. He made himself smile. Made himself clap Callahan on the shoulder again. I'm fine, he said. Now let's get back to town.
Chapter 5. The Meeting of the Falcon. 1. Tian Jaffords had never been more frightened in his life than he was as he stood on the stage in the pavilion, looking down at the Falcon of Calabrin Sturgis. He knew there were likely no more than 500, 600 at the very outside, but to him it looked like a multitude, and their taut silence was unnerving. He looked at his wife for comfort and found none there. Zelia's face looked thin and dark and pinched, the face of an old woman rather than one still well within her childbearing years. Nor did the look of this late afternoon help him find calm. Overhead, the sky was a pellucid, cloudless blue, but it was too dark for 5 o'clock. There was a huge bank of clouds in the southwest, and the sun had passed behind them just as he climbed the steps to the stage. It was what his grandpere would have called weirding weather. Omenish, say thank you. In the constant darkness that was Thunderclap, lightning flashed like great sparklights. Had I known it would come to this, I'd never have started it a-goin', he thought wildly. And this time there'll be no Pear Callahan to haul my poor old ashes out of the fire. Although Callahan was there, standing with Roland and his friends, they of the hard calibers, with his arms folded on his plain black shirt with the notched collar and his man Jesus cross hanging above. He told himself not to be foolish, that Callahan would help and the outworlders would help as well. They were there to help. The code they followed demanded that they must help, even if it meant their destruction and the end of whatever quest they were on. He told himself that all he needed to do was introduce Roland, and Roland would come. Once before, the gunslinger had stood on this stage and danced the Kamala and won their hearts. Did Tian doubt that Roland would win their hearts again? In truth, Tian did not. What he was afraid of in his heart was that this time it would be a death dance instead of a life dance. Because death was what this man and his friends were about. It was their bread and wine. It was the sherbet they took to clear their palates when the meal was done. At that first meeting, could it have been less than a month ago? Tian had spoken out of angry desperation, but a month was long enough to count the cost. What if this was a mistake? What if the wolves burned the entire Kala flat with their lightsticks, took the children they wanted one final time, and exploded all the ones that were left, old, young, in the middle, with their whizzing balls of death? They stood waiting for him to begin, the gathered Kala. Eisenharts and Overholzers and Javiers and Tooks, without number, although no twins among these last, of the age the wolves liked, I know. Such lucky Tooks they were. Telford standing with the men and his plump but hard-faced wife with the women. Strongs and Rossiters and Slightmans and Hands and Rosarios and Pocellas. The Manny once again bunched together like a dark stain of ink. Henchick, their patriarch, standing with young Cantab, whom all the children liked so well. Andy, another favorite of the kiddies, standing off to one side with his skinny metal arms akimbo and his blue electric eyes flashing in the gloom. The sisters of Oriza bunched together like birds on fence wire, Tian's wife among them, and the cowboys, the hired men, the day boys, even old Bernardo, the town tosspot. To Tian's right, those who had carried the feather shuffled a bit uneasily. In ordinary circumstances, one set of twins was plenty to take the Apopanax feather. In most cases, people knew well in advance what was up, and carrying the feather was nothing but a formality. This time, it had been Margaret Eisenhart's idea, 3 sets of twins had gone together with the hallowed feather, carrying it from town to smallhold, to ranch, to farm, in a bucca driven by Cantab, who sat unusually silent and songless up front, clucking along a matched set of brown mules that needed precious little help from the likes of him. Oldest at 23, were the Hagengood twins, born the year of the last wolf raid, and ugly as sin by the lights of most folks, although precious hard workers say thank you. Next came the Tavery twins, those beautiful map-drawing town brats. Last, and youngest, although eldest of Tien's brood, came Hedden and Hedda. And it was Hedda who got him going. Tien caught her eye and saw that his good, although plain-faced, daughter had sensed her father's fright and was on the verge of tears herself. Eddie and Jake weren't the only ones who heard the voices of others in their heads. Tien now heard the voice of his grandpere. Not as Jamie was now, doddering and nearly toothless, but as he had been 20 years before. Old, but still capable of clouting you over the river road if you sassed back or dawdled over a hard pull. Jamie Jaffords, who had once stood against the wolves, this Tien had from time to time doubted. But he doubted it no longer, because Roland believed. "Garn, then," snarled the voice in his mind. "What is it, fashes and diddles thee, so slow, o' thing? 'Tis nubber to say his name and stand aside, ain't it? Then, for good earnest, you can let him do a rest." Still Tien looked out over the silent crowd a moment longer, their bulk hemmed in tonight by torches that didn't change, for this was no party, but only glared a steady orange. Because he wanted to say something, perhaps needed to say something. If only to acknowledge that he was partly to credit for this, for good or for Nis. In the eastern darkness, lightning fired off silent explosions. Roland, standing with his arms folded like the pair, caught Tien's eye and nodded slightly to him. Even by warm torchlight, the gunslinger's blue gaze was cold, almost as cold as Andy's. Yet it was all the encouragement Tien needed. He took the feather and held it before him. Even the crowd's breathing seemed to still. Somewhere far over town, a rusty cawed as if to hold back the night.
"Not long since I stood in yon gathering hall and told thee what I believe," Tien said, "that when the wolves come they don't just take our children, but our hearts and souls. Each time they steal and we stand by, they cut us a little deeper. If you cut a tree deep enough, it dies. Cut a town deep enough, that dies too."
The voice of Rosalita Munoz, childless her whole life, rang out in the fey dimness of the day with clear ferocity.
"Say true, say thank you, hear him, folk, and hear him very well."
"Hear him, hear him, hear him well," ran through the assembly.
"Pear stood up that night and told us there were gunslingers coming from the northwest, coming through mid-forest along the path of the beam. Some scoffed, but Pear spoke true."
"Say thank you," they replied. "Pear said true."
And a woman's voice,
"Praise Jesus, praise Mary, Mother of God."
"They've been among us all these days since. Any who's wanted to speak to them has spoke to them. They have promised nothing but to help.
And a move on, leaving bloody ruin behind him, if we're foolish enough to allow it,"
Eben Took roared. There was a shocked gasp from the crowd. As it died, Wayne Overholzer said,
"Shut up, you great mouth organ!"
Took turned to look at Overholzer, the Kala's big farmer and Took's best customer, with a look of gaping surprise.
Tien said, "Their din is Roland Deshane of Gilead."
They knew this, but the mention of such legendary names still provoked a low, almost moaning murmur.
"From in-world that was, would you hear him? What say you, folken?"
Their response quickly rose to a shout. "Hear him, hear him, we would hear him to the last, hear him well, say thank you." And a soft, rhythmic, crumping sound that Tien could not at first identify. Then he realized what it was and almost smiled. This was what the tromping of shore boots sounded like, not on the boards of the gathering hall, but out here on Lady Rise's grass. Tien held out his hand. Roland came forward. The tromping sound grew louder as he did. Women were joining in, doing the best they could in their soft town shoes. Roland mounted the steps. Tien gave him the feather and left the stage, taking Hedda's hand and motioning for the rest of the twins to go before him. Roland stood with the feather held before him, gripping its ancient lacquered stalk with hands now bearing only 8 digits. At last, the tromping of the shoes and shore boots died away. The torches sizzled and spat. illuminating the upturned faces of the Falcon, showing their hope and fear, showing both very well. The Rusty called and was still. In the east, big lightning sliced up the darkness. The gunslinger stood facing them. 2. For what seemed a very long time, looking was all he did. In each glazed and frightened eye, he read the same thing. He had seen it many times before, and it was easy reading. These people were hungry. They'd fain buy something to eat, fill their restless bellies. He remembered the pie man who walked the streets of Gilead Lowtown in the hottest days of summer, and how his mother had called him Seppi Sai on account of how sick such pies could make people. Seppi Sai meant the death cellar. Aye, he thought, but I and my friends don't charge. At this thought, his face lit in a smile. It rolled years off his craggy map, and a sigh of nervous relief came from the crowd. He started as he had before. We are well met in the Kala. Hear me, I beg. Silence. You have opened to us. We have opened to you, is it not so?
Aye, gunslinger, Von Eisenhardt called back. Tis.
Do you see us for what we are, and accept what we do? It was Henchik of the Manny who answered this time.
Aye, Roland, by the book, and say thank you. Ye are availed. White come to stand against black.
This time the crowd's sigh was long. Somewhere near the back, a woman began to sob. Kala Falcon, do you seek aid and succor of us? Eddie stiffened. This question had been asked of many individuals during their weeks in Kala Bryn Sturgis, but he thought to ask it here was extremely risky. What if they said no? A moment later, Eddie realized he needn't have worried. In sizing up his audience, Roland was as shrewd as ever. Some did in fact say no, a smattering of haycoxes, a peck of tooks, and a small cluster of Telfords led the antis. But most of the Falcon roared out a hearty and immediate, Aye, say thank you. A few others, Overholzer was the most prominent, said nothing either way. Eddie thought that in most cases this would have been the wisest move, the most politic move anyway. But this wasn't most cases. It was the most extraordinary moment of choice most of these people would ever face. If the Quartet of 19 won against the Wolves, the people of this town would remember those who said no and those who said nothing. He wondered idly if Wayne Dale Overholzer would still be the big farmer in these parts a year from now. But then Roland opened the palaver, and Eddie turned his entire attention toward him, his admiring attention. Growing up where and how he had, Eddie had heard plenty of lies, had told plenty himself, some of them very good ones. But by the time Roland reached the middle of his spiel, Eddie realized he had never been in the presence of a true genius of mendacity until this early evening in Kala Bryn Sturgis. And Eddie looked around, then nodded, satisfied. And they were swallowing every word. 3. Last time I was on this stage before you, Roland began, I danced the Kamala. Tonight, George Telford interrupted. He was too oily for Eddie's taste and too sly by half, but he couldn't fault the man's courage, speaking up as he did when the tide was so clearly running in the other direction.
Aye, we remember, ye danced it well. How dance ye the mortata, Roland? Tell me that, I beg.
Disapproving murmurs from the crowd. Doesn't matter how I dance it, Roland said, not in the least discommoded, for my dancing days in the Kala are done. We have work in this town, I and mine. Ye've made us welcome, and we say thank you. Ye've bid us on, sought our aid and succor, so now I bid ye to listen very well. In less of a week come the Wolves. There was a sigh of agreement. Time might have grown slippery, but even Low Falcon could still hold on to 5 days' worth of it. On the night before their due, I'd have every Kala twin child under the age of 17 there, Roland pointed off to the left, where the Sisters of Ariza had put up a tent. Tonight there were a good many children in there, although by no means the 100 or so at risk. The older had been given the task of tending the younger for the duration of the meeting, and one or another of the sisters periodically checked to make sure all was yet fine.
"That tent won't hold them all, Roland," Ben Sleitman said.
Roland smiled. "But a bigger one will, Ben, and I reckon the sisters can find one."
"Aye, and give them a meal they won't ever forget,"
Margaret Eisenhart called out bravely. Good-natured laughter greeted this, then sputtered before it caught. Many in the crowd were no doubt reflecting that if the wolves won after all, half the children who spent Wolf's Eve on the green wouldn't be able to remember their own names a week or two later, let alone what they'd eaten.
"I'd sleep 'em here so we can get an early start the next morning," Roland said. "From all I've been told, there's no way to know if the wolves will come early, late, or in the middle of the day. We'd look the fools of the world if they were to come extra early and catch 'em right here in the open."
"What's to keep 'em from coming a day early?"
Eben Took called out truculently.
"Or at midnight on what you call Wolf's Eve?"
"They can't," Roland said simply. And, based on Jamie Jaffords' testimony, they were almost positive this was true. The old man's story was his reason for letting Andy and Ben Sleitman run free for the next 5 days and nights. "They come from afar, and not all their traveling is on horseback. Their schedule is fixed far in advance."
"How do you know?"
Lewis Haycox asked.
"Better I not tell," Roland said. "Mayhap the wolves have long ears."
A considering silence met this. On the same night, Wolf's Eve, I'd have a dozen bucka wagons here, the biggest in the Kala, to draw the children out to the north of town. I'll appoint the drivers. There'll also be childminders to go with them and stay with them when the time comes, and you needn't ask me where they'll be going. It's best we not speak of that either." Of course, most of them thought they already knew where the children would be taken. The Old Gloria. Word had a way of getting around, as Roland well knew. Ben Sleitman had thought a little further, to the Redbird too, south of the Gloria, and that was also fine. George Telford cried out,
"Don't listen to this, Falcon, I beg you, and even if you do listen, for your souls and the life of this town, don't do it. What he's saying is madness. We've tried to hide our children before, and it doesn't work. But even if it did, they'd surely come and burn this town for vengeance' sake, burn it flat."
"Silence, you coward."
It was Henchik, his voice as dry as a whipcrack. Telford would have said more regardless, but his eldest son took his arm and made him stop. It was just as well. The clumping of the shore boots had begun again. Telford looked at Eisenhart unbelievingly, his thought as clear as a shout.
"You can't mean to be part of this madness, can you?"
The big rancher shook his head.
"No point looking at me so, George. I stand with my wife, and she stands with the eld."
Applause greeted this. Roland waited for it to quiet.
"Rancher Telford says true. The wolves likely will know where the children have been bunkered, and when they come, my quartet will be there to greet them. It won't be the first time we've stood against such as they."
Roars of approval. More soft clumping of boots, some rhythmic applause. Telford and Eben Took looked about with wide eyes, like men discovering they had awakened in a lunatic asylum. When the pavilion was quiet again, Roland said,
"Some from town have agreed to stand with us. Folka with good weapons. Again, it's not a thing you need to know about just now."
But of course the feminine construction told those who didn't already know about the Sisters of Ariza a great deal. Eddie once more had to marvel at the way he was leading them. Cozy wasn't in it. He glanced at Susanna, who rolled her eyes and gave him a smile. But the hand she put on his arm was cold. She wanted this to be over. Eddie knew exactly how she felt. Telford tried one last time.
"People, hear me. All this has been tried before."
It was Jake Chambers who spoke up.
"It hasn't been tried by gunslingers," sighed Telford.
A fierce roar of approval met this. There was more stamping and clapping. Roland finally had to raise his hands to quiet it.
"Most of the wolves will go to where they think the children are, and we'll deal with them there," he said. "Smaller groups may indeed raid the farms or ranches. Some may come into town. And aye, there may be some burning."
They listened silently and respectfully, nodding, arriving ahead of him to the next point, as he had wanted them to. A burned building can be replaced. A ruined child cannot.
"Aye," said Rosalita, "nor a ruined heart."
There were murmurs of agreement, mostly from the women. In Calabrin Sturgis, as in most other places, men in a state of sobriety did not much like to talk about their hearts.
"Hear me now, for I tell you at least this much more. We know exactly what these wolves are. Jamie Jaffords has told us what we already suspected."
There were murmurs of surprise. Heads turned. Jamie, standing beside his grandson, managed to straighten his curved back for a moment or two and actually puff up his sunken chest. Eddie only hoped the old buzzard would hold his peace over what came next. If he got muddled and contradicted the tale Roland was about to tell, their job would become much harder. At the very least, it would mean grabbing Sleitman and Andy early. And if Finley Otego, the voice Sleitman reported to from the Dogon, didn't hear from these two again before the Day of the Wolves, there would be suspicions. Eddie felt movement in the hand on his arm. Susanna had just crossed her fingers.
4. "There aren't living creatures beneath the masks," Roland said. "The wolves are the undead servants of the vampires who rule Thunderclap." An awed murmur greeted this carefully crafted bit of claptrap. "They're what my friends Eddie, Susanna, and Jake call zombies. They can't be killed by bow, ba, or bullet unless struck in the brain or the heart." Roland tapped the left side of his chest for emphasis. "And of course, when they come on their raids, they come wearing heavy armor under their clothes."
Henchik was nodding. Several of the other older men and women, Falcon, who well remembered the wolves coming not just once before but twice, were doing the same.
"It explains a good deal," he said. "But how?"
"To strike them in the brain is beyond our abilities, because of the helmets they wear under their hoods," Roland said. "But we saw such creatures in Lud. Their weakness is here." Again he tapped his chest. "The undead don't breathe, but there's a kind of gill above their hearts. If they armor it over, they die. That's where we'll strike them."
A low, considering hum of conversation greeted this, and then Grandpere's voice, shrill and excited,
"'Tis ever word true for Dinna Molly Doolin strike on their cell with a dish, and not even dead on either, and yet the creature dropped down."
Susanna's hand tightened on Eddie's arm enough for him to feel her short nails, but when he looked at her, she was grinning in spite of herself. He saw a similar expression on Jake's face. "Trig enough when the chips were down, old man," Eddie thought. "Sorry I ever doubted you. Let Andy and Sleitman go back across the river and report that happy horseshit." He'd asked Roland if they, the faceless they represented by someone who called himself Finley Otego, would believe such tripe.
"They've raided this side of the Hwy for over 100 years and lost but a single fighter," Roland had replied. "I think they'd believe anything. At this point, their really vulnerable spot is their complacence."
"Bring your twins here by 7 o'clock on Wolf's Eve," Roland said. "There'll be ladies, sisters of Oriza, you ken, with lists on slate boards. They'll scratch off each pair as they come in. It's my hope to have a line drawn through every name before 9 o'clock.
"Ye'll not drag no line through the names of mine,"
cried an angry voice from the back of the crowd. The voice's owner pushed several people aside and stepped forward next to Jake. He was a squat man with a small-holed rice patch far to the southwards. Roland scratched through the untidy storehouse of his recent memory, untidy, yes, but nothing was ever thrown away, and eventually came up with the name, Neil Faraday.
one of the few who hadn't been home when Roland and his quartet had come calling. Or not home to them, at least. A hard worker, according to Tian, but an even harder drinker. He certainly looked the part. There were dark circles under his eyes and a complication of burst purplish veins on each cheek. Scruffy, say big, big. Yet Telford and Took threw him a grateful, surprised look. Another sane man in bedlam, it said. Thank the gods.
"They'll take in babbies any row, and burn in Squabbit Town flat," he said, speaking in an accent that made his words almost incomprehensible. "But they'll have one each of my, see, and that'll steal me three, and a best. They ain't worth Squabbit, but my Hogan is."
Faraday looked around at the townsfolk with an expression of sardonic disdain.
"Burn ye flat and be damned to ye," he said. "Numb gits."
And back into the crowd he went, leaving a surprising number of people looking shaken and thoughtful. He had done more to turn the momentum of the crowd with his contemptuous and, to Eddie at least, incomprehensible tirade than Telford and Took had been able to do together.
"He may be shirt-tail poor, but I doubt if he'll have trouble getting credit from Took for the next year or so," Eddie thought. "If the store still stands, that is."
"Cy Faraday's got a right to his opinion. But I hope he'll change it over the next few days," Roland said. "I hope you folks will help him change it, because if he doesn't, he's apt to be left not with three kitties, but none at all." He raised his voice and shaped it toward the place where Faraday stood, glowering. "Then he can see how he likes working his tillage with no help but two mules and a wife." Telford stepped forward to the edge of the stage, his face red with fury.
"Is there nothing you won't say to win your argument, you chary man? Is there no lie you won't tell?"
"I don't lie, and I don't say for certain," Roland replied. "If I've given anyone the idea that I know all the answers, when less than a season ago I didn't even know the wolves existed, I cry your pardon. But let me tell you a story before I bid you good night. When I was a boy in Gilead, before the coming of the good man and the great burning that followed, there was a tree farm out to the east of Barony."
"Whoever heard of farming trees?"
someone called derisively. Roland smiled and nodded. "Perhaps not ordinary trees, or even ironwoods, but these were Blossies, a wonderful light wood, yet strong. The best wood for boats that ever was. A piece cut thin nearly floats in the air. They grew over 1,000 acres of land, tens of thousands of blosswood trees in neat rows, all overseen by the barony forester. And the rule, never even bent, let alone broken, was this: take two, plant three."
"Aye," Eisenhart said, "'tis much the same with stock, and with threaded stock the advice is to keep four for every one you sell or kill. Not that many could afford to do so."
Roland's eyes roamed the crowd. "During the summer season I turned 10, a plague fell on the Blosswood Forest. Spiders spun white webs over the upper branches of some, and those trees died from their tops down, rotting as they went, falling of their own weight long before the plague could get to the roots. The forester saw what was happening, and ordered all the good trees cut down at once, to save the wood while it was still worth saving, do you see? There was no more take two and plant three, because the rule no longer made any sense. The following summer, the Blossy Woods east of Gilead was gone." Utter silence from the falcon. The day had drained down to a premature dusk. The torches hissed. Not an eye stirred from the gunslinger's face. "Here in the Kala, the wolves harvest babies, and needn't even go to the work of planting them, because, hear me, that's the way it is with men and women. Even the children know. Daddy's no fool when he plants the rice kamala. Mommy knows just what to do." A murmur from the falcon. "The wolves take, then wait. Take, and wait. It's worked fine for them, because men and women always plant new babies, no matter what else befalls. But now comes a new thing. Now comes plague." Took began.
"Aye, say true, you're a plague, or a—"
Then someone knocked the hat off his head. Eben took world, looked for the culprit, and saw 50 unfriendly faces. He snatched up his hat, held it to his breast, and said no more.
"If they see the baby farming is over for them here," Roland said, "this last time they won't just take twins. This time they'll take every child they can get their hands on while the taking's good. So bring your little ones at 7 o'clock. That's my best advice to you."
"What choice have you left them?"
Telford asked. He was white with fear and fury. Roland had had enough of him. His voice rose to a shout, and Telford fell back from the force of his suddenly blazing blue eyes.
"None that you have to worry about, Si, for your children are grown, as everyone in town knows. You've had your say. Now why don't you shut up?"
A thunder of applause and boot stomping greeted this. Telford took the bellowing and jeering for as long as he could, his head lowered between his hunched shoulders like a bull about to charge. Then he turned and began shoving his way through the crowd. Took followed. A few moments later, they were gone. Not long after that, the meeting ended. There was no vote. Roland had given them nothing to vote on. "No," Eddie thought again as he pushed Susanna's chair toward the refreshments. "Cozy really wasn't in it at all." 5. Not long after, Roland accosted Ben Sleitman. The foreman was standing beneath one of the torch poles, balancing a cup of coffee and a plate with a piece of cake on it. Roland also had cake and coffee. Across the greensward, the children's tent had for the nonce become the refreshment tent. A long line of waiting people snaked out of it. There was low talk, but little laughter. Closer by, Benny and Jake were tossing a spring ball back and forth, every now and then letting Oi have a turn. The bumbler was barking happily, but the boys seemed as subdued as the people waiting in line.
"He spoke well tonight," Sleitman said, and clicked his coffee cup against Roland's.
"Do you say so?"
"Aye. Of course they were ready, as I think you knew, but Faraday must have been a surprise to you, and you handled him well."
"I only told the truth," Roland said. "If the wolves lose enough of their troop, they'll take what they can and cut their losses. Legends grow beards, and 23 years is plenty of time to grow a long one. Kalafokan assume there are thousands of wolves over there in Thunderclap, maybe millions of them, but I don't think that's true." Sleitman was looking at him with frank fascination.
"Why not?"
"Because things are running down," Roland said simply. And then, "I need you to promise me something." Sleitman looked at him warily. The lenses of his spectacles twinkled in the torchlight.
"If I can, Roland, I will."
"Make sure your boy's here 4 nights from now. His sister's dead, but I doubt if that untwins him to the wolves. He's still very likely got what it is they come for." Sleitman made no effort to disguise his relief.
"Aye, he'll be here. I never considered aughtn' else."
"Good. And I have a job for you, if you'll do it." The wary look returned.
"What job would it be?"
"I started off thinking that 6 would be enough to mind the children while we dealt with the wolves, and then Rosalita asked me what I'd do if they got frightened and panicked."
"Ah, but you'll have him in a cave, won't you?"
Sleitman asked, lowering his voice.
"Kitties can't run far in a cave, even if they do take fright."
"Far enough to run into a wall and brain themselves, or fall down a hole in the dark. If one were to start a stampede on account of the yelling and the smoke and the fire, they might all fall down a hole in the dark. I've decided I'd like to have an even 10 watching the kiddos. I'd like you to be one of them."
"Roland, I'm flattered."
"Is that a yes?" Sleitman nodded. Roland eyed him.
"You know that if we lose, the ones minding the children are apt to die."
"If I thought you were going to lose, I'd never agree to go out there with the kids."
He paused.
"Or send my own."
"Thank you, Ben. These are good men."
Sleitman lowered his voice even further.
"Which of the mines is it going to be? The Gloria or the Redbird?"
And when Roland didn't answer immediately,
"Of course I understand if you'd rather not tell."
"It's not that," Roland said. "It's that we haven't decided."
"But it'll be one or the other."
Oh, aye, where else? Roland said absently, and began to roll a smoke.
And you'll try to get above them.
Wouldn't work, Roland said. Angle's wrong. He patted his chest above his heart. Have to hit him here, remember. Other places no good. Even a bullet that goes through armor wouldn't do much damage to a zombie.
It's a problem, isn't it?
It's an opportunity, Roland corrected. You know the scree that spreads out below the adits of those old garnet mines? Looks like a baby's bib.
Aye?
We'll hide ourselves in there, under there. And when they ride toward us, we'll rise up and... Roland cocked a thumb and forefinger at Sleitman and made a trigger-pulling gesture. A smile spread over the foreman's face.
Roland, that's brilliant.
No, Roland contradicted, only simple. But simple's usually best. I think we'll surprise them. Hem them in and pick them off. It's worked for me before. No reason it shouldn't work again.
No, I suppose not.
Roland looked around. Best we not talk about such things here, Ben. I know you're safe, but... Ben nodded rapidly.
Say no more, Roland. I understand.
The spring ball rolled to Sleitman's feet. His son held up his hands for it, smiling.
Pa, throw it!
Ben did, and hard. The ball sailed, just as Molly's plate had in Grandpere's story. Benny leaped, caught it one-handed, and laughed. His father grinned at him fondly, then glanced at Roland.
They's a pair, ain't they? Yours and mine?
Aye, Roland said, almost smiling. Almost like brothers, sure enough. 6. The quartet ambled back toward the rectory, riding 4 abreast, feeling every town eye that watched them go, death on horseback.
You happy with how it went, sugar? Susanna asked Roland.
It'll do, he allowed, and began to roll a smoke.
I'd like to try one of those, Jake said suddenly.
Susanna gave him a look, both shocked and amused.
Bite your tongue, sugar. You haven't seen 13 yet. My dad started when he was 10, and he'll be dead by 50 like as not, Susanna said sternly. No great loss, Jake muttered,
but he let the subject drop. What about Mia? Roland asked, popping a match with his thumbnail. Is she quiet?
If it wasn't for you boys, I'm not sure I'd believe there even was such a Jane.
And your belly's quiet, too?
Yes.
Susanna guessed everyone had rules about lying. Hers was that if you were going to tell one, you did best to keep it short. If she had a chap in her belly, some sort of monster, she'd let them help her worry about it a week from tonight. If they were still able to worry about anything, that was. For the time being, they didn't need to know about the few little cramps she'd been having. Then all's well, the gunslinger said. They rode in silence for a while, and then he said, I hope you two boys can dig. There'll be some digging to do. Graves? Eddie asked, not sure if he was joking or not. Graves later looked up sky, but the clouds had advanced west and stopped. The wind to dim. 6. Before the storm. 1. Rising up from the darkness, dolorous and accusatory, came the voice of Henry Dean, the great sage and eminent junkie.
I'm in hell, bro. I'm in hell, and I can't get a fix, and it's all your fault.
How long will we have to be here, do you think?
Eddie asked Callahan. They had just reached the doorway cave, and the great sage's little bro was already shaking a pair of bullets in his right hand like dice. 7 come 11, baby need a little peace and quiet. It was the day after the big meeting, and when Eddie and the pair had ridden out of town, the high street had seemed unusually quiet. It was almost as if the collar was hiding from itself, overwhelmed by what it had committed itself to.
I'm afraid it'll be a while, Callahan admitted.
He was neatly and nondescriptly, he hoped, dressed. In the breast pocket of his shirt was all the American money they'd been able to put together, 11 crumpled dollars and a pair of quarters. He thought it would be a bitter joke if he turned up in a version of America where Lincoln was on the single and Washington on the 50s.
But we can do it in stages, I think.
Thank God for small favors, Eddie said, and dragged the pink bag out from behind Tower's bookcase.
He lifted it with both hands, began to turn, then stopped. He was frowning.
What is it?
Callahan asked.
There's something in here.
Yes, the box.
No, something in the bag. Sewn into the lining, I think. It feels like a little rock. Maybe there's a secret pocket.
And maybe, Callahan said, this isn't the time to investigate it.
Still, Eddie gave the object another small squeeze. It didn't feel like a stone, exactly, but Callahan was probably right. They had enough mysteries on their hands already. This one was for another day. When Eddie slid the ghostwood box out of the bag, a sick dread invaded both his head and his heart.
I hate this thing. I keep feeling like it's going to turn on me and eat me like a taco chip.
It probably could, Callahan said. If you feel something really bad happening, Eddie, shut the damn thing.
Your ass would be stuck on the other side if I did.
It's not as though I'm a stranger there, Callahan said, eyeing the unfound door.
Eddie heard his brother. Callahan heard his mother, endlessly hectoring, calling him Donnie. He'd always hated being called Donnie.
I'll just wait for it to open again.
Eddie stuffed the bullets into his ears.
Why are you letting him do that, Donnie?
Callahan's mother moaned from the darkness.
Bullets in your ears, that's dangerous.
Go on, Eddie said. Get it done.
He opened the box. The chimes attacked Callahan's ears and his heart. The door to everywhere clicked open. 2. He went through thinking about two things. The year 1977 and the men's room on the main floor of the New York Public Library. He stepped into a bathroom stall with graffiti on the walls. Bango Skank had been there, and the sound of a flushing urinal somewhere to his left. He waited for whoever it was to leave, then stepped out of the stall. It took him only 10 minutes to find what he needed. When he stepped back through the door into the cave, he was holding a book under his arm. He asked Eddie to step outside with him and didn't have to ask twice. In the fresh air and breezy sunshine, the previous night's clouds had blown away, Eddie took the bullets from his ears and examined the book. It was called Yankee Highways.
The father's a library thief, Eddie remarked. You're exactly the sort of person who makes the fees go up.
I'll return it someday, Callahan said.
He meant it.
The important thing is I got lucky on my second try. Check page 119.
Eddie did. The photograph showed a stark, white church sitting on a hill above a dirt road. East Stoneham Methodist Meeting Hall, the caption said. Built 1819. Eddie thought, Adam, come out with 19, of course. He mentioned this to Callahan, who smiled and nodded.
Notice anything else?
Of course he did.
It looks like the Collar Gathering Hall.
So it does. It's twin, almost.
Callahan took a deep breath.
Are you ready for round two?
I guess so.
This one's apt to be longer, but you should be able to pass the time. There's plenty of reading matter.
I don't think I could read, Eddie said. I'm too fucking nervous, pardon my French. Maybe I'll see what's in the lining of the bag.
But Eddie forgot about the object in the lining of the pink bag. It was Susanna who eventually found that. And when she did, she was no longer herself. 3. Thinking 1977, and holding the book open to the picture of the Methodist Meeting Hall in East Stoneham, Callahan stepped through the unfound door for the second time. He came out on a brilliantly sunny New England morning. The church was there, but it had been painted since its picture had been taken for Yankee Highways, and the road had been paved. Sitting nearby was a building that hadn't been in the photo, the East Stoneham General Store. Good.
He walked down there, followed by the floating doorway, reminding himself not to spend one of the quarters which had come from his own little stash unless he absolutely had to. The one from Jake was dated 1969, which was okay. His, however, was from 1981, and that wasn't. As he walked past the mobile gas pumps, where regular was selling for 49 cents a gallon, he transferred it to his back pocket. When he entered the store, which smelled almost exactly like Took's, a bell jingled. To the left was a stack of Portland Press Heralds, and the date gave him a nasty little shock. When he'd taken the book from the New York Public Library not half an hour ago by his body's clock, it had been June 26th. The date on these papers was the 27th. He took one, reading the headlines, a flood in New Orleans, the usual unrest among the homicidal idiots of the Mideast, and noting the price, a dime. Good. He'd get change back from his 69 quarter. Maybe buy a piece of good old made-in-the-USA salami. The clerk looked him over with a cheerful eye as he approached the counter.
"That do it?" he asked.
"Well, I tell you what," Callahan said, "I could use a point toward the post office if that does you."
The clerk raised an eyebrow and smiled.
"You sound like you're from these parts."
"Do you say so, then?"
Callahan asked, also smiling.
"Yep. Anyway, post office is easy. Ain't but a mile down this road on your left."
He pronounced road, rud, exactly as Jamie Jaffords might have done.
"Good enough. And do you sell salami by the slice?"
"I'll sell it just about any old way you want to buy it,"
the clerk said amiably.
"Summer visitor, are you?"
It came out summer visitor, and Callahan almost expected him to add, "Tell me, I beg."
"You could call me that, I guess," Callahan said.
4. In the cave, Eddie fought against the faint but maddening jangle of the chimes and peered through the half-open door. Callahan was walking down a country road. Goody gumdrops for him. Meantime, maybe Mrs. Dean's little boy would try having himself a bit of a read. With a cold and slightly trembling hand, he reached into the bookcase and pulled out a volume two down from one that had been turned upside down, one that would certainly have changed his day had he happened to grab it. What he came up with instead was 4 short novels of Sherlock Holmes. Ah, Holmes, another great sage and eminent junkie. Eddie opened to A Study in Scarlet and began to read. Every now and then he found himself looking down at the box where Black 13 pulsed out its weird force. He could just see a curve of glass. After a little bit, he gave up trying to read, only looking at the curve of glass, growing more and more fascinated. But the chimes were fading, and that was good, wasn't it? After a little while, he could hardly hear them at all. A little while after that, a voice crept past the bullets in his ears and began to speak to him. Eddie listened. 5.
"Pardon me, ma'am."
"Aya?"
The postmistress was a woman in her late 50s or early 60s, dressed to meet the public with hair of a perfect beauty shop blue-white.
"I'd like to leave a letter for some friends of mine," Callahan said. "They're from New York, and they'd likely be general delivery customers."
He had argued with Eddie that Calvin Tower, on the run from a bunch of dangerous hoods who would almost certainly still want his head on a stick, wouldn't do anything so dumb as sign up for mail. Eddie had reminded him of how Tower had been about his fucking precious first editions, and Callahan had finally agreed to at least try this.
"Summer folk?"
"Do ya?" Callahan agreed, but that wasn't quite right. "I mean, Their names are Calvin Tower and Aaron Deepno. I guess that isn't information you're supposed to give someone just in off the street, but..."
"Oh, we don't bother much about such things out in these parts," she said.
Parts came out pots.
"Just let me check the list. We have so many between Memorial Day and Labor Day."
She picked up a clipboard with 3 or 4 tattered sheets of paper on it from her side of the counter. Lots of handwritten names. She flicked over the first sheet to the second, then from the second to the third.
"Deepno,"
she said.
"There's that one. Now, just let me see if I can find t'other one."
Never mind, Callahan said. All at once he felt uneasy, as though something had gone wrong back on the other side. He glanced over his shoulder and saw nothing but the door and the cave and Eddie sitting there cross-legged with a book in his lap.
Got somebody chasing you?
The post lady asked, smiling. Callahan laughed. It sounded forced and stupid to his own ears, but the post lady seemed to sense nothing wrong. If I were to write Aaron a note and put it in a stamped envelope, would you see that he gets it when he comes in? Or when Mr. Tower comes in?
Oh, no need to buy a stamp, said she comfortably. Glad to do it.
Yes, it was like the collar. Suddenly he liked this woman very much, liked her big, big. Callahan went to the counter by the window, the door doing a neat do-si-do around him when he turned, and jotted a note, first introducing himself as a friend of the man who had helped Tower with Jack Andolini. He told Deepnow and Tower to leave their car where it was and to leave some of the lights on in the place where they were staying and then to move somewhere close by, a barn, an abandoned camp, even a shed. To do it immediately, leave a note with directions to where you are under the driver's side floor mat of your car or under the back porch step, he wrote. We'll be in touch. He hoped he was doing this right. They hadn't talked things out this far, and he'd never expected to have to do any cloak and dagger stuff. He signed, as Roland had told him to, Callahan of the Eld. Then, in spite of his growing unease, he added another line, almost slashing the letters into the paper. And make this trip to the post office your last. How stupid can you be? He put the note in an envelope, sealed it, and wrote Aaron Deepnow or Calvin Tower, general delivery, on the front. He took it back to the counter. I'll be happy to buy a stamp, he told her again.
Nope, just 2 cents for the envelope and we're square.
He gave her the nickel left over from the store, took back his 3 cents change, and headed for the door, the ordinary one.
Good luck to you,
the post lady called. Callahan turned his head to look at her and say thanks. He caught a glimpse of the unfound door when he did, still open. What he didn't see was Eddie. Eddie was gone. 6. Callahan turned to that strange door as soon as he was outside the post office. Ordinarily, you couldn't do that. Ordinarily, it swung with you as neatly as a square dance partner, but it seemed to know when you intended to step back through. Then you could face it. The minute he was back, the toad ash chimes seized him, seeming to etch patterns on the surface of his brain. From the bowels of the cave, his mother cried,
There now, Donnie, you've gone and let that nice boy commit suicide. He'll be in Pergy forever, and it's your fault.
Callahan barely heard. He dashed to the mouth of the cave, still carrying the Press Herald he'd bought in the East Stoneham General Store, under one arm. There was just time to see why the box hadn't closed, leaving him a prisoner in East Stoneham, Maine, circa 1977. There was a thick book sticking out of it. Callahan even had time to read the title, 4 Short Novels of Sherlock Holmes. Then he burst out into sunshine. At first he saw nothing but the boulder on the path leading up to the mouth of the cave, and was sickeningly sure his mother's voice had told the truth. Then he looked left and saw Eddie 10 feet away, at the end of the narrow path and tottering on the edge of the drop. His untucked shirt fluttered around the butt of Roland's big revolver. His normally sharp and rather foxy features now looked puffy and blank. It was the dazed face of a fighter out on his feet. His hair blew around his ears. He swayed forward, then his mouth tightened and his eyes became almost aware. He grasped an outcrop of rock and swayed back again. He's fighting it, Callahan thought, and I'm sure he's fighting the good fight, but he's losing. Calling out might actually send him over the edge. Callahan knew this with a gunslinger's intuition, always sharpest and most dependable in times of crisis. Instead of yelling, he sprinted up the remaining stub of path and wound a hand in the tail of Eddie's shirt just as Eddie swayed forward again, this time removing his hand from the outcrop beside him and using it to cover his eyes in a gesture that was unmeaningly comic. Goodbye, cruel world. If the shirt had torn, Eddie Dean would undoubtedly have been excused from Ka's great game.
but perhaps even the tails of homespun Kala Bryn Sturgis shirts, for that was what he was wearing, served Ka. In any case, the shirt didn't tear, and Callahan had held on to a great part of the physical strength he had built up during his years on the road. He yanked Eddie back and caught him in his arms, but not before the